Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I am going to be your host today. So we are talking with Paul Tompkins today from Flippin' Experts. How are you doing today, Paul?
Hey, great, Kirk. Man, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I'm really excited to have you here. And I know we get tons of requests here for people looking for help with real estate. Real estate seems to be the hot topic for the year, given all that's going on in the market. So maybe you could tell listeners a bit about your background.
I kind of have a crazy background of how I even got started in real estate. At 18 years old, went to the United States Marine Corps. I did that for a couple years, 4 years, got honorably discharged, and then went to become a Florida State Trooper. And did that for quite some time. And while being a trooper, it was awesome. They gave me everything I ever wanted, right? They're like, here's a fast car, here's a gun and a badge, go catch bad guys. And I was like, that's like every kid's dream. Like I dreamed about it when I was young. So it was awesome to have that job. But as time went on, I'm 7, 8 years in, I'm starting to look at, okay, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Like, I can't live on $36,600 a year. Florida troopers don't make hardly any money. It's not like the North. But I was like, there's got to be a better way. Being a police officer, they had us work in different shift work every month. So every month you worked a different shift. You were on a midnight shift 1 month. The very next month you're on a day shift. The next month you're on a night shift. So it makes it very hard to have quality family time. I was missing football games with my son. I wasn't seeing my spouse as much as I'd wanted to. I wasn't having those weekends off where I could go hang out with friends. And it just really started to hinder what I thought life would look like. On top of, I'm putting my life at risk every day. I'm only making a little bit of money. And I started looking at real estate. I said, hey, there's other things out there. I know people are invested in real estate. And I started researching it. And I'm looking at millionaires and billionaires and where they have their money and how are they making more money and how is it generational wealth? And kind of the vehicle that I found is real estate. And I dove in with both feet. They didn't have all this online training back there. You know, YouTube wasn't cranking back then, but I had to figure out a way. And that's what I did. I did it part-time. I was still a full-time state trooper. I was still 40, 50 hours a week as a trooper. And on the side, I was learning real estate and doing real estate. And going into my second and my third year part-time, I was making $300,000 in real estate, just flipping houses and properties. So I finally got my whereabout, you know, but got my belt on and I figured out everything and I dug deep and I was like, man, I just need to quit this trooper job. And everybody's like, just stay in a little bit longer, like figure it out, dig deep. There's goods, there's bads, there's hard times. And I'm glad I did because 2008 hit. And then we went through that big whole debacle, right? And I had never been through something like that before. I'd always had a job, right? I was with the state. I was getting pension. I had medical, I had everything, but going through 2008, I saw how everything radically changed and how the markets can affect you and all that. So I'm not glad that it happened, but I'm glad I was able to go through it and learn. And here I am today, still doing 40 to 50 deals every single year. I'm running rental properties. I'm doing all this other stuff. So I just like that real estate. Like I could touch it. I could feel it. I could buy it. I could sell it. I could renovate it. I could rent it. It was always something I could touch. So I just finally said, hey, I'm all in. I went full time and now we have multiple companies that are doing it and loving every minute of it.
I think there's a lot of good lessons that we can pull out of there. I think what a lot of people do is they think, oh, I'm going to go into real estate and they just jump in with both feet. But that presents a lot of challenges. So I'd love to kind of take it back a step or two to kind of think about, just really talk about how you went from that step from, you know, working as a trooper to starting in real estate, because it's a big leap. It's not like a small leap, like you just test it with $100. It's a big jump. So how did you kind of make that kind of mental shift?
I've always been about finding the expert, right? Find the person that's doing it better than you, bigger than you, whatever it might be. It doesn't matter if it's photography or it doesn't matter what it is, who is where you want to be and find that person. And that's what I did. I found a guy that was doing it in Jacksonville, Florida, and drove a nice car, beautiful house on the water, big boat. Like that doesn't impress me, but that shows me proof of concept. That lets me know he's doing something right. And it was longevity. It wasn't just, hey, I'm moving some cash around. I went up and I met with him and it was funny because I was still a state trooper at the time and I knew his office. I knew right where it was at. So I pulled in one day with my patrol car, with my uniform on, and I walk in and you just see like everybody's eyes, like, cause he had like 15 employees and they're all just like, oh, who did something wrong? And I was like, hey, who's the owner? And I knew the guy's name and went to the back. I was like, I need to talk to you about something. He's closing the door like, oh boy, this isn't good. And I was like, hey man, I want to get involved in real estate. And you just see his like, you know, you just, and I said, listen, I'll clean your trash out. I'll clean the toilets. I'll clean your office. I'll file papers. I want to learn. I want to be there when you do real estate deals. And that's what I did for a year. I followed him around and I learned. So really it was, I knew I wanted to do it. I was committed. That was my first step. And then my second step was like reaching out to somebody who could help me achieve it. Like I said, there wasn't all these online courses and stuff that you can go take right now and get instant information and really good information. But I got to see some good things. I got to see some bad things. And I'm like, okay, I can use this. I can use this. I'm not going to do this. I saw him get in trouble with that. And then I just went out on my own. And during that year of him coaching and mentoring me, I'm lining up money guys. Like, hey, how do you get a money guy? How do you get hard money? What's the best way to get money? I'm picking his brain and getting that information from him. So it wasn't just cold turkey. You know, you're right. So many people, they dive in both feet. I want to quit my job, Paul. I just had a student literally a couple weeks ago make $98,000. Well, his third flip. And I always teach, I'm like, stick with your full-time job. You're learning this. You're educated. It's like you're in college, right? You're like, you're still in training. There's no reason to go all in, keep doing it part-time, keep doing four houses a year and making 50 to 100 grand a house. Like, that's good. And he did, and everything's going great for him.
When you're flipping houses, let's talk about this for a minute, just so listeners can understand. So when you're flipping houses, are you adding value back in, or are you just kind of like flipping contracts, or what does that look like for you?
The only time I really wholesale is when I get too many properties on my plate. You know, I average 18 to 25 at a time. So it just depends how many deals I have. If I get an influx of where I'm sitting on five deals, I might wholesale a couple of those deals. And that's just selling contracts, right? My bread and butter is actually buying it at a discounted price, renovating it. And my average is 30,000 to 60,000 in renovation. So yes, bringing a lot of value to the property. I mean, we basically turn that into almost a new construction home when you think about it. Now, there's some properties that maybe only have a 10-year-old kitchen or a 10-year-old bathroom, cabanities and stuff like that, where we might just go in and refinish them versus putting all brand new in. But when you buy one of our homes, it's turnkey, it's beautiful, there's islands in the kitchen, there's pendant lights, there's brand new flooring. We're kind of going all out and selling it for the full max ARV.
When you're doing a fix, you know, part of the flip, what are you doing? Are you going through the whole house? Are you looking for properties that are easy to flip, meaning like you only have to do the kitchen or you only have to do one thing? Or are you like, how do you analyze that from your perspective?
That's a great question. And I think there's a balance of everything, right? There's houses that I can get in and out in 2 weeks and only put in $20,000. So maybe I don't take as much as a profit. Maybe if my profit's at 20% return after everything, that I can lower to 15 because I'm in and out so fast. And I know the property's going to sell. I know it's a 3-2. I know it's 1500 square foot. Like, who doesn't want a house like that? Everybody wants a house like that. And then there's other ones that are $100,000 rehabs that are, it's going to tie my crew up for 6-7 weeks. Well, if I do the easy ones, I can flip them every 2 weeks, but it also depends on my inventory, like how much inventory is coming in. And that's basically how I build out. I go after the big ones, but I try to only do a couple of those a year. We're doing a $250,000 renovation right now, but that profit margin's so big. So it makes it worth it because there's so many more site visits. There's so many more moving parts. There's so many more subs. So I would say our company's niche is more of the, what will 80% of the nation want to buy? Is it a 3-2, 1500 square foot and bigger? That's kind of our model. Will we go to 1200? Sure. Do I go after 2-1s and 2-2s? No. Do I go after $2 million properties? No. Now, if one comes across my plate that's worth 800 grand and I can buy it for 400 and it just needs 100,000 in renovation and I can make 250, 300 on it, yeah, I'll pick it up depending on how much I have going on.
Great insight to kind of hear what you're willing to do and not do. Because I think a lot of people just say, hey, it's a good deal. I'm just going to do that. They don't kind of break it down. But it sounds like, I mean, you've been doing this long enough. You have a team in place. You've got these systems in place. But I would think if you're starting, it's probably really hard because right now you've got a construction team that can just go in and do that. But what about somebody who's, this is their first deal. They don't have those kind of resources. How do they make the leap for that first fix and flip?
There's people that you can partner with. And Kurt, that's a really good way to get started. I know a lot of people, I just did a Q&A last night and some people were saying, well, hey, should I wholesale first? I think that's a great avenue to start, especially part-time, right? There's no money in, but you're learning to talk to people. You're learning how to negotiate. You're learning to inspect properties. You're learning how to write a contract. So like wholesaling is a great avenue to get started. And if you do that for a couple months, during that time, what happens? You can start building relationships. There's so many meetup sites out there that you can go to for real estate industry where, I mean, literally every week you can go to one where you meet money people, you meet contractors, you meet realtors, you meet inspectors, you meet all these different people that you're going to need on your team to help you move a property faster. So I know a lot of people that start at wholesaling first. I know other people that say, hey, listen, I just want to do one house a quarter. And if my profit's $40,000 a house, I know I'm going to be making $160,000 profit a year. And to them, that's not stressful. I know other people that are, I want to do one or two a year. I know other people that are, how do I get to 10 as fast as possible? But building that good foundation, Kurt, is like, for me, it's taking your time. It's getting yourself educated. It's meeting the right people. Having a coach in your area even is a big deal. Like California is way different than Florida. Their pricing is different. The way their mindset works is different. What people are looking for is different. So it's great to get training from other places, but once you go for that leap, have a local coach that you can, hey, does this sound right to you? Is this wrong? How should I adjust this? And this guy's telling me this, is that right? And somebody you can bounce ideas off.
It sounds like, I mean, when you started, you're just doing smaller deals, single deals, and now you're doing a lot more deals. And you've also, we talked about before the show, you kind of vertically integrated beyond the fix and flips. You're doing other things like rentals and home design company and staging and your academy. So how did you, what caused you to want to do that just beyond just basic fix and flips?
Because I was already doing everything else. So when you think about fix and flips, that's the perfect opportunity for the rental industry, right? If I'm buying at 60 cents on the dollar, well, that's the best place to buy a rental, number one. If I already have the crew to go in there and do the work at 50, 60 cents on the dollar, right? Because I do so much volume, instead of paying someone 100% to go in and do a full rehab, I saved money. So the rental just made sense to me. I'm like, I get to cherry pick which ones I want to keep forever. The ones I renovate, I know they're done right. I know the roofs are new, the ACs are new, the flooring's new, the plumbing's new. Like, I get to cherry pick. And then when we started staging houses, it was, well, I'm staging all my own anyway because it makes them sell faster. I get more showings. Within my second showing, I usually have an offer on almost all my properties. I think one was over two showings. I mean, everything else, one to two showings, multiple offers. So I knew that why pay somebody to come in and stage it if I'm doing volume? And all the investors in the area knew me, right? They're all like, hey, Paul, come stage my house too. Well, if I'm staging 50 of my own houses a year and I can pick up 200 other houses, why not start a staging company, do it all myself and make the money off of that? And then it went into design and my wife handles design with some team members and people started calling us up like, hey, can you design our house? And I'm like, well, we really don't do that, but yeah, why not? And then we just threw a number out and it stuck and people are like, yeah, we'll pay that. And then it turned into home design and personal home renovations. I don't want to go out there and I didn't start this to go out there and do other people's houses, but what are we seeing right now? The market's asking for that because inventory's so low. I mean, you can go sell your house for $500,000, but how are you going to go buy another house for that? There's no inventory, at least where I'm at. Everybody I'm talking to, it's like inventory's gone. You list your house within a day or two, it's under market, under contract if it's a good quality product. So what people are doing now is saying, well, I have 80,000 in the bank. Why don't I just renovate my own home? So I said, I can fulfill that need, right? COVID hit. What did everybody do during COVID? Every wife was like, I want this done. I want this done. I want this done. And they didn't want you in their house for those 2 or 3 months, but now it's exploding. And they're like, hey, I'll just renovate my own house, get it the way I want. I don't have to move. I don't have that stress. I don't have to go through a loan. So we said, hey, we already have the know-how. We already have the crews. We already have a portfolio we can show these people and the profit margin is great. So why not just grow that? So we hired more people and said, hey, you need to handle that department. And now that's growing and thriving as well. So it all falls in real estate. And that's what we like. Like it all branches off and I can pull in my contractors. I can pull in my designer. I can pull in my staging company. I can pull in my experts that are acquisition guys and find deals. So it just worked out well.
Timely too, given COVID, because a lot of things change for people. And the more diverse kind of business you have, the more likely you are to kind of be able to sustain those tough times. And you mentioned in terms of volume, like what do you do for volume now compared to when you started?
I think when I started, again, I was part-time when I started. I was probably doing 8 to 12 houses a year. Those profits were probably $40,000 to $50,000 consistently over deals. And now I'm more in the 40s and 50s. But I had to change my mindset a little bit, Kurt. My mindset was like, how do I do more houses a couple years ago instead of how do I do less houses with more profit? Like 2 years ago, I would have said, man, I'm aiming for 100. Now I'm like, I'd love to do 40 with bigger profit margins, with less stress and less money out. So that's what we're working towards now. It's 40 or 50 fix and flips. I'm picking up 5 to 10 rentals a year and doing it consistently over time, right? Real estate's not a rush. Real estate is longevity. It's take your time, learn. When you rush, you make mistakes. And then the personal home side came in and we're like, okay, let's build this up. So that takes a little bit more of my energy, not a lot, but it takes up more, but I'm growing another stream. So right now we just have like 4 or 5 balls floating and they're all doing wonderful and doing good. And then if one starts to not make as much and I can cut it and put that time and energy into something that's making a bigger return or making a better impact, then I can easily shift that.
So what caused you to make that shift? Because I think it's hard when you kind of go down a path and you have this goal, you want to have a certain number of houses and whatever you set. And I've gone through this shift myself where you start with a goal and you realize halfway through, you're like, it's not motivating or it's the wrong goal and you got to shift your language. So what caused you to kind of come to that point where you realize like, hey, this is not the goal I actually want to hit?
Workload. I mean, literally workload and stress. When I sit there and go, why take on twice as many deals? That's going to take twice as much energy, conversations, hiring, right? Hiring more contractors to move them in a timely manner versus I have a great system in place. What can I do to fix it and make it better? How can I buy properties instead of 75 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar? Do I need to create an acquisition team that works harder and smarter that finds me cheaper deals? So for me, it was just, I didn't want to fall back into that state trooper mindset of like, I'm working all the time. I'm missing my family. I can never go on vacation. Work, work, work. Like that's not the lifestyle that I want at all. I want to be a solid dad, a solid husband. That's more of important to me. So me just shifting my mindset and saying, hey, what's the most important right now? And it was this. And then, okay, how do I get what I want, but do it a smarter way? A lot of it, Kurt, like I reach out to my coaches. I have a coach that I pay a lot of money every single month and every single year. And I go to these big conferences where I'm part of a mastermind. And I'm like, guys, you're there. You're doing 300 houses a year. How are you doing it? And he's like, well, here's how I do it, Paul. And I put this person in place and this business in place. And I shifted it. So I'm learning from guys that are where I want to go that have already made all the mistakes that I don't want to make. And for me, I'm okay paying that money to be in that mastermind or to learn from them, because I put it in the simplest terms. Like if, let's just say you do 10 houses a year. And if you learn something about a home flip that can save you $5,000 a house, that's 50 grand you saved. And that's just in 1 year. But what if you do this for the next 20 years? It all compounds. So for me, I'm okay paying for speed. I'm okay paying for the experts. I don't want to go try this and try that. And I hope this works. Now, what works because you've been there? And that's helped me a lot, Kurt.
So you do what, single family homes or, and why?
Yeah, single family is my sweet spot. I have some apartment complexes that I own. I have some other properties that I own, but single family is where I like to be.
Do you see yourself staying in that? Because I would think that as you get bigger, you would probably have to grow the size of the acquisitions as opposed to just doing more of them.
We already are. We're already looking at bigger deals and multifamily and how many doors, all these different things. I think the reason I like single family is because it helps my rental portfolio grow faster. And for me, I can sell single family a lot faster than and for more money because I'm selling it to an individual versus an investor. Like, hey, I can only sell these 18 units. Only an investor is going to buy that versus I can sell a home at top dollar and it's only a small fraction of that money, right? If that 18 unit apartment place is $2 million, but my homes are only 250, I can drop off 250 anytime I want and get top dollar for it. That's kind of my mindset, but we are growing into bigger things. It's just right now we have 5 or 6 things going that we want to focus on and make them excellent first.
Let's just say somebody wanted to kind of follow in your footsteps, right? And kind of do something. There's many ways to invest in real estate, but let's say they want to take a similar path to you. What are the qualities you think that they should have as a person or things that they would need to have to be successful in that way?
Determination. Like you're all in. Like you own this business. You might not have been a CEO yesterday, but when you decide to do real estate and you start your LLC, like you are a CEO now, everything falls on your shoulders. So determination, stamina. I mean, there's certain nights where I work till 11 o'clock at night to get a deal done. There's other nights where I'm taking phone calls or I'm on vacation and I'm taking phone calls from people. So like, but then there's certain times where I'm off for 3 weeks and nobody talks to me and I go fishing and do this. So there's a balance there, but if you're going to go in, go all in. Determine it like, hey, I'll go part time and I'll do it for a season until I feel comfortable. And then if I decide to go full time, I'm going to have somebody guide me through it. But determination, stamina, just know what you want and go after it.
I think a lot of people look at real estate as this kind of like, you know, sexy kind of aspirational thing that they can do. And they like the aspect that it's quote unquote passive income. I'm not sure where they get that idea, but it's somehow passive. If somebody's looking to get into this field, what are things that they should really understand from kind of like, I guess the darker side of this, or what are the things that aren't really talked about, but are problematic that people should understand?
Plan for the worst, hope for the best. I mean, that's what I do in my deals. I build margins into everything. I mean, you don't know anything about a house until you own the house and you do work in the house. Everybody thinks that throw up shiplap and everything's going to sell and everything's wonderful. I mean, there's a lot of work that comes into having a crew that goes in and doesn't just do a renovation, does quality work. They show up every day. They're not on drugs. There's no excuses or drama. There's just a lot of moving pieces. And the more organized you are and what those moving pieces are, and how to handle them, the more successful you're going to be. But there's more sunshine and rainbows than cloudy days. I think I've lost money on one deal in my whole life, and that's because a hurricane came through. And 2 weeks after it hit the market, a hurricane came through and flooded the house 4 feet. So I had to do the renovation all over again with mold and all that in a historic district. But I only lost $10,000. So you take the good with the bad, you take the good days with the bad days, but at the end of the day, you're your own boss. You go where you want, you do what you want. You just got to put the grind in. And I think a lot of people don't understand like flippers or people with rentals. I mean, you don't just buy a rental, like you said, and it's just passive income for life. Like, oh, that's it. No, like you better go out and visit that property and maintain it and make sure it's still making you money. It's like, hey, I'm just going to go to the gym twice and stop for the year because I'm buff enough. Like, no, you have to maintain. You have to keep doing it. You have to keep that thing, getting those checks coming in the mail. I do see that a lot where people kind of idolize that, or even sometimes on our cruise, it's the same thing. It's like, man, I want to be where you're at, Paul. I'm like, dude, you have no idea what goes on in my daily life. Like, I'm up at 5 a.m. and I'm wrapping up at 10 o'clock at night. Like, it doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, I'm my own boss and I get to do what I want and have the lifestyle that I want. So it's worth it.
It's good for most people to understand because I think it's an aspirational goal. But what people don't understand is what goes into that. A lot of long nights and extra work on weekends when people are out, you know, with their families. And sometimes you got to put in that extra work. So that's great insight. You said you work with your wife too. That must be interesting. I know some people are more successful that than others, because I think it can be a challenge working with your spouse. So I don't know if you can maybe kind of talk about that a little bit and, you know, what people should think about if they're considering that.
It's surprising, Kirk. I get so many podcast requests like, hey, come talk about how you and your wife are doing it. Like, I think a lot of it just comes down to balance. A lot of it. You got to remember, like, you're working with her and it's not just 8 hours and you're going home, right? Work is it goes home with you. It doesn't stay at the office because the emails are following you. But then you're sleeping with your spouse. You're at home with your spouse. You're on vacation with your spouse. So for us, I can only tell you what works for me. I give her space. She gives me my space. So she's a night owl. She doesn't want to have to come out of the bedroom before 10. Like, she gets up at 9. She reads the Bible, she reads a book, she plays with the dog, and then at 10, she's ready to go to work. And for me, I was like, that's not gonna work, babe. I've been up since 5. Babe, we got this. And I put that stress on her. So it was very hard because she wasn't happy. And finally, one day, I don't even know where it came from. Like, I was in my kitchen and I said, write down, I could tell she was stressed. I was like, write down what a great day looks like for you. Like right now, I slid her a piece of paper and a pen and she literally wrote out hour by hour. And I was like, I can do that. I said, I'm going to work on doing that. And that's what we did. I said, okay, don't come out. I said, well, if you come out of that bedroom, game's on. You come out at 9:40, I'm throwing stuff at you. She started laughing. And for me, I'm up cranking in the morning. So at night, after like 6 o'clock, I'm like, if I don't have to talk business, I don't want to. But at night she works, right? She's doing all the design and picking out the lighting packages and figuring out this. And I'm like, you can do that as long as it doesn't come into my space. Like, I need my downtime. I want to go play with the horses. I want to go with the dog. I want to go work out. And she gave me that space. So we know from 10 o'clock to about 6 o'clock at night is our working together space. She has family a couple hours away. So she gets to go on the weekends and spend the whole weekend with her sisters and her mom, where I'll go and hang out with my buddies. Or I'll go fishing. I'll go play golf. So So just really taking that time and separating it. But I think if you respect each other and you're saying, hey, these are boundaries we need to work within, like there's certain things that she hates doing. It just drives her insane. And I said, who can we hire to take that off your plate? And that's what we did. And guess what? The next week, she's in a way better mood. Why? Because she's not dealing with accounting. She's not dealing with ordering this or dealing with that. Why? Because I paid somebody $15 an hour to take it off her plate. That's easy. So making sure it's a win for your spouse, whether it's a guy or a girl, I think you'll go really far with that.
It's hard. I see it a lot when people work with their spouse and there's good and bads to it. As we kind of get close to wrapping up here, any good books you'd recommend for people? Things that kind of helped you kind of transition your mindset?
High Performance Habits by Brendan Burchard is one of my favorite. My mind's wired that way. I'm a big daily planner, lay out my day, lay out my week ahead of time. That's always helped me. I probably accomplished twice as much in a day just by taking 15, 20 minutes in the morning or the night before and actually writing it out. And like mine are in like 15 minute intervals. When I first got the book, I'm like, 15 minutes, man. And then sure enough, as I kept in doing it, it just helped me be more productive and less stressed. Like I think for me, I carry stress when I don't know what the day entails. If I can lay out what tomorrow holds, and I still have buffers in there, right? I still have an hour block where I don't have anything. In an hour block, I don't have anything. So if something moves or shifts, I'm not freaking out. But like I carry stress when I don't know what I'm going to do for the next day. I'm like, okay, we have 18 projects going on. Who's supposed to be where? And I'm trying to oversee managers, but I haven't had a conversation like, hey, manager meeting, 9 to 10, that's out of the way. I've talked to everybody about every project. Like, and it lets me build out my day. That takes a lot of stress off me. And then I just read another one, Capital Gains by Chip Gaines. I love his book. I love how simple it was. I'm a simple guy. I don't need like these big fancy words, but like Chip showed us where Magnolia came from, right? And then he showed us what they're doing. And then to see him take that and build so many different brands out of that, him and his wife, he shared the future in the book. And I like that. I like a person that has a vision and it's not about him or just their business, but like, hey, here's where I want to get one day. Who can help me on this journey? Like, I like that kind of stuff because I think it brings hope into the world and hope into people's lives. And it's just a great read. I loved what they did with their business. It was cool reading about it.
Well, appreciate those recommendations. I think those are always helpful. People are always asking us, like, what should I read? What should I read? As we kind of wrap up here, what final thoughts can you leave our listeners with?
Our company has always been big on take the next step. I don't even know where it came from, but like when you were talking about like, well, how did you create all these other streams? It was just taking a step every day, right? It was like, I was hearing what the customers were saying. I was hearing what homeowners were saying. I'm hearing what investors were saying about needing their property staged. So I was just listening, but then I took a step on it. So it doesn't matter what industry you're in. If you're taking a step towards your goal, even if it's one step a day, I mean, that's 365 steps in a year. Like that's a ton of steps towards your dream and goals, or you can sit there and do nothing. Our company, we always talk about like, if there's a problem or there's something we're trying to solve, it's like, okay, let's take one step. Like action has to be taken, even if it's small. That's what I would just tell your listeners. Like, it doesn't matter what your dream or goal is, or if it's real estate or not, great. But like, just take one step today towards it, but you have to do the same thing tomorrow and the same thing the next day, and you're going to get where you want to go.
Where can listeners find more about you?
Yeah, they can go to our website at flippinexperts.com. There's no G in flippin. It's just FLIPPIN experts.com. They can go check us out on social media, any of those platforms. We're on there. We give away a lot of free training and all that.
That was a great interview with Paul Tompkins. And we have an exciting panel this week. It's been hard to contain ourselves in the conversations prior to the show. So I think the listeners are really going to enjoy this. This week, we have our very own Megan Gorman. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm doing great, Kirk. How are you?
Doing great. We also have our very own Barbara Friedberg. Hey, Barb.
Hey, Kirk. I'm having a hard time controlling myself. I'm ready to go.
Good. And we also have a surprise guest panelist. We have Mindy Jensen. How are you doing today, Mindy?
Kirk, I am doing great. And I am just as excited as Barb and Megan to talk about this episode today.
Good. Well, let's dive in. And I'm glad we have Mindy here this week because Mindy was kind enough to have me on her show a few weeks ago, which was great. Really appreciate that. And we want to have her back here because we're talking about topics that are really close to near and dear to her heart. We're talking about flipping real estate. And for those of you who don't know Mindy, how do you look at flipping real estate? Because I know you love this topic.
So I do a slightly different version of flipping real estate. I do something called a live-in flip, which means that I actually live in the property while the construction is going on. I'm living in the construction zone. And if my life sounds glamorous, it is, because that's super fun. We're getting ready to do drywall next week, and I am so excited. That is the messiest job on the planet. And I'm being facetious. I actually hate drywall very much. But I make a lot more money than Paul does, because I pay no capital gains taxes when I sell my properties. And the way I do that is I'm living in my primary residence and I am improving it. And if you live in a property for 2 out of the last 5 years, then you pay no capital gains up to $250,000 if you are single and up to $500,000 if you are married when you go to sell the house, because it's your primary residence. That is the way that I flip houses. And I just really love taking an ugly, ugly house and making it beautiful.
Barb, what about you? You know, you love flipping houses too. What are your thoughts?
Yes. Back in decades ago, when I first got my start, I was passionate about finding these undervalued properties and then totally renovating them and then either renting them out or reselling them. But what I'd like to mention to people today is this sounds so freaking glamorous. It is not. The money is great. Yeah, we all love money, but this is not an easy job, because if you don't buy the property right, then your profit is going to be squeezed. So you can't just go out there and find a decrepit house and buy it for whatever price. You have to buy it for the right price.
Well, clearly you've never seen HGTV flipping show. That's exactly what they do. They just go out and buy any old house.
Oh my gosh.
There's no problems.
They make it look so freaky, and you can get it done in an hour. That's the part that I like.
And it always appraises, and it's always slightly over budget. That's the part that I find so much exception with, because it's never slightly over budget. It's always way over budget. You can't see through drywall. And every time you open up a wall, there's like the weirdest stuff behind that drywall. So you're absolutely right. It is not a glamorous job at all. It sounds glamorous, but then you get into it and you're like, ugh.
Well, and the other thing I wanted to mention is you've got to be living in the right geographic area, because there are some areas where the demand for real estate so outstrips the supply that it is virtually impossible to buy a house to renovate and resell and make a profit. Or the house that you do find requires so much money that most people just don't have the cash to be able to get into it. So, for example, I live in San Francisco. Forget about it. It's just not going to happen.
You know, it's funny you bring that up, Barb, because I also live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, the prices here are just insane. But I'm from a small town in southern New Jersey, and I went through the process this summer of potentially buying a house that needed to just be renovated and then to flip it. And I guess because I was such a finance person, you know, I had run the numbers 6 ways to Sunday, and I had done research, because when you're in a small town, you got to sort of know some of the local aspects of it to understand the risks of flipping. And one of the things I was aware of when I was trying to put the bid in on the house was that because of Hurricane Sandy, the municipality had changed the rules. And if you had improved a property more than half of the assessed value, you were going to be required to lift the house for flood purposes. And this house I was trying to buy had an assessed value, I believe, of like $50,000. And I had run the numbers and I knew point blank that I was not going to be able to renovate it for less than half of that. And so it just fell apart, the whole deal. So I get, you know, I agree, Barb, that certain areas you have to look at the marketplace to understand if there's these opportunities available. And then I think the thing is, I ended up seeing this property sell eventually, but I knew that it wasn't going to be glamorous and that the numbers were going to be really, really challenging because of all these little issues in the municipality.
Well, and another thing is that people just don't get is, unless you're doing the renovation yourself, which most of us don't have the skills for electrical, plumbing, carpentry, you know, in our back pockets, have you ever managed a crew of workers? Mindy, you can speak to that, I'm sure.
Well, actually, it's like herding cats. So no, I can't speak to that, because I actually do all of the work My husband and I do all the work ourselves. Remember, we're living in the property, and in you have to check your municipality's rules and regulations. But if you are the homeowner, you are allowed to do the work yourself. If you are not the homeowner, you have to hire this out. And yeah, that's a nightmare. I mean, even finding a contractor to actually call you back, regardless of getting them to do the work, getting them to actually call you back is a difficult task.
And why do you say that, Mindy?
They are so busy. Think about it. If you've got a, let's call it a $1,000, $2,000 electrical job, they've already got 50 other people calling them for a $10,000 electrical rewire. Why are they going to bother with your little $1,000 job? Or it's so painful to me to see these contractors who are actually really good workers just not even look ahead and consider that this job that they're currently on will end. They just wait for the phone to ring again. And I swear somebody could make $1 billion if they would just start a company that scheduled contractors, you know, answer the phone when people called. When you get somebody to answer the phone and they say, oh, sorry, we can't get there for 6 weeks, that frustrates you, but then you call them back because they're the only person who actually answered. There's just so much work right now and so few people doing the work.
And that so depends on a market, because in 2008, when we bought actually our primary residence, and it was in the just the worst real estate crash in decades, people were lining up. I needed the property painted, and I had literally 15 people that were chomping at the bit. Flash forward 10 years later, and I'm trying to get my house repainted. Oh, no, we're so busy. We can't see you. No. So much of this also depends on the market timing that you're in.
Oh, I completely agree. In 2008, you know, 2007, people were still entering the business, 2006, 2007. Then the construction trades crashed 2008, 2009, 2010. A lot of those people left the construction trades, got jobs in another industry, and haven't come back. There's a company in Denver that will train you from nothing to be a construction worker, an electrician, a plumber, whatever. And then after they train you, you have to work for them for a year and you get paid while you get trained. And I don't know if this is still happening, but this was like 6 months ago. I knew somebody going through this program. Construction companies are desperate to hire people.
I want to touch on a few areas here. So, you know, Mindy and Barb, you had mentioned about, you know, good and bad parts of the country. Kind of in your experience, what are some of the, I guess, the better and the worst parts of the country? I mean, I know, Barb, where you are, and Megan, where you are, and certainly where I am, it's not, the numbers don't work out that well. But maybe what are some good areas that people should look at where there are opportunities where people can do this and make money? Mindy, what are your thoughts?
The places that people want to live are where you're going to find great opportunities for flipping. I'm in Colorado and everybody wants to move to Colorado. I guess it got out that our weather is amazing. The first state to legalize pot didn't hurt anything either. And you hear people say, oh, I want to move to Colorado because I want to go skiing every week, or I want to go, you know, I want to hike all the time. They've got the mountains. You don't hear people, and I'm not talking trash about Cincinnati, but you don't hear people say, oh, it's my dream to move to Cincinnati. Or Wisconsin or Iowa or Illinois has actual negative population growth. I used to live in Illinois and I don't live there now. And, you know, when there's job opportunities and growth opportunities, that's also where you start to find some tight real estate markets where, you know, a property comes on the market and it's instantly under contract. Whereas if you look in some of the Midwest states, there maybe has a lot more days on market time. So if there's jobs, that's also a big one. People need to generate income to pay their rent or their mortgage. When companies are closing, people are desperate to get out of their house. That's not a good time to start flipping houses when people aren't moving there.
Okay, first of all, I'm from Cincinnati. So I think we got to get
are
out
you serious?
The now. Yes. And that is where I first started my flipping. And by the way, have you seen the new riverfront walkway in Cincinnati? It is.
I haven't.
Okay. Well, aside from the fact that Mindy is now on my enemies list, I'd like to bring up kind of a contrary view to what Mindy said, which is, yeah, you want to flip where people want to live for sure. but you also need to flip in an area that you can afford to buy a house at a bargain price. So if the area is too desirable or too competitive, then, you know, you're not going to be able to get the good deals. So if we can go back to my hometown, Cincinnati, which, by the way, is a lovely city. No, but cities in the Midwest, I mean, even think Detroit, Michigan, which has just gone through hell and high water over the past couple of decades. These are some of the places where they may not have hugely growing populations, but there are enough people there that need housing. And you also have the combined benefit that you can buy some bargains there. It's not only is it a great place to live, in fact, it may not even be a great place to live, but if you can get a bargain and you can renovate a house and you can put it on the market at a fair or even slightly below market price due to the fact that you were smart in your buying and renovating, then you have a great chance of making a profit.
It's funny. I want to add one thing to this because I want to bring up my favorite topic, which is taxes. Mindy's way of approaching flipping is very tax efficient. She's living in the houses she's flipping. She knows the rules that you have to be there 2 out of the past 5 years to get the, if you're married, $500,000 exemption, or if you're single, $250,000 exemption. But what most people forget to build in is what is the cost of having to, of doing a flip if you don't live in it as your primary residence. And I bring that up because I think that taxes can sometimes be very, very painful. So what I would suggest to anyone as they start to think about doing a flip is look at what the possible tax implications can be. And I bring that up because in the beginning, if you start to do flipping, you typically, and you're not living in it like Mindy does, you can typically use that the capital gains rate on those gains. But what happens is that as time goes on, you're going to be deemed a real estate person or someone who is in the business of real estate. And what can happen on your tax return is you can shift from being in capital gains rates to being in ordinary income tax rates. And so you really need to make sure that you are paying attention to this because the tax bite can be incredibly painful.
I'm just so pleased that we have these different viewpoints on this show because, yeah, I always forget about the taxes because I don't have to pay them. But I have to live in a construction zone. I want to make sure that everybody knows that is not fun. I am mortified that I chose the one city that Barbara's from.
Mindy, you made my day, so please do not be mortified. This was the most fun I've had all day, and I've been up for an hour and a half.
And I do like that you said that you can buy it for a bargain price and then also sell it. Yes, you can make money flipping houses in almost any market. You just have to make sure that you know the market.
A few things I want to chime in here. One is obviously that we've been talking about the taxes with the live and flip, but obviously when you're flipping a house and no one is living there, then you're not getting that quote unquote income. But when you're living there, you're losing your expense, your kind of homeowner expense, as opposed to having like two houses that you're paying for. Another point I want to make is also we were talking about, and we'll try not to mention any more cities.
And Kirk, I have lived in literally 7 different locations. So I'm just putting it out there, guys, that you might hit on another one of my locations.
I'll go back to Detroit, Michigan, because I'm pretty sure no one comes from there. What I want to make the point of is because I remember back in, I think it was, I don't know, 2008, 2010, when you could buy a house in Detroit, Michigan for $100. There were articles about this online about, you know, houses you could pick up for $100 in Detroit. I think what's important to recognize is, you know, there is a risk to reward balance here. Places like San Francisco or Boston, I mean, Boston is notoriously bad right now. We were talking before the show. I mean, you know, if you're looking at cap rates, you're getting like a 2 cap on a Boston. It's ridiculous. And there's no extra land and people are finding that there's just, it's hard to find new places. So there's a real challenge in Boston. Then you go to the other end of the spectrum, like Detroit, where you can I'm not sure you can pick it up for $100, but let's just say that as an example where you can pick it up cheap, but you've got this huge amount of risk because it's not exactly in the most desirable location. So you have to have that balance of don't just look at the numbers, but you know, look at the whole equation, look at the job growth, look at what the city is doing. I mean, when I went to college, it was in Hartford, and Hartford is not the most desirable city to live in, so much so that people live in the suburbs and almost nobody lives in the city. But towards the end of my college career, the city was actually going through a little bit of a, I'd call it kind of a rebirth in a sense, in that they were putting money in, some restaurants were coming in. It didn't last very long, but there was a trend of them trying to get people back into the city. So you have to really understand the trends too. And I think that's important too. I want to touch back on, I want to go back to Megan here. We were talking about tax treatment and we were talking about entities before the show. So maybe we could kind of talk a little bit about if people are doing fix and flips, like how should you hold it? Should you hold it in your name? Should it be an entity?
When we think about entities, what we really want to be thinking about is how am I protecting myself? And I want to take Mindy's situation first because I think it's a good example. Mindy's living in the house as her primary residence. So what I hope Mindy has is that she also has an umbrella policy which on her homeowner's coverage for the house. And I would tell her that if I were in her situation, she should be working with an insurance broker who could advise her that when she's doing certain projects on the house, how to make sure does she get extra protection when she has maybe a subcontractor coming in the house to do work. Because you want to protect yourself from any liability. But for people who have rental properties, one of the questions I get asked the most is, should I set up an LLC? And when you set up an entity, you have to remember you're basically creating something for that will have a tax consequence. And that tax consequence might be as simple as you have to file a certain type of return once a year. So when you do an LLC, you know, the benefits of it is you are protecting yourself against liability. And if you own a rental property or if you're flipping a house and you are having people all around, you're treating this as a business. You want to make sure that you have the ability to protect yourself if someone slips and falls or gets injured on the site. So having an LLC will help with that. Now, I will tell you, if you're doing a lot of work on the policy, you probably also need, I mean, doing a lot of work on the property, you probably also need some sort of additional liability policy while work is going on that you won't need if you're renting the property out and not flipping it. But what most people do when they do LLCs is they set one up for each property and they think of each property as its own separate entity and own separate tax filing. And the reason you would do that is you want to be able, when you're doing a flip, to have a separate profit and loss statement for each of the properties so that you can truly see what each of these properties are earning and costing you. Now, the LLC adds liability protection, but you also have to remember to get that benefit, you have to put up with some hassles. So one, you have to set up an entity. And most people who do this do what we call a SMLLC or a single member LLC. And what that means for income tax purposes is it's a pass-through. There's no additional federal filing if you have a single member LLC. It passes through right onto your 1040. So that makes the federal side of things easier. However, when you do set up an LLC, there's paperwork. States have filing fees. I'm sitting here in California where on an annual basis, just to have the LLC, you have to pay $800. And I'll put an asterisk next to that just because California is going to have a little tax break from 2021 to 2023 that if you set up a new LLC, you don't have to pay the $800. And then when you have the LLC, you know, there might also be other state tax filings for income tax purposes. And then sometimes with an LLC, it can be more challenging to qualify for a mortgage. So you just have to be aware of that. But that's the trade-off for getting liability protection.
Mindy, what about you? You're doing a live-in flip. So do you set up any sort of entities?
I don't, because I'm not sure if I could get the tax credits if I flipped it in an LLC. But I know that I can get it in my own name. So I do that. I don't have an umbrella policy, Oopsie. So I'm going to have to look into that. Like I said, though, we are doing all the work ourselves. And that's, again, with an asterisk, because I am not doing drywall. I don't do drywall. I don't do roofs. I don't do gutters, because those jobs are really horrible.
Because you're living in a personal residence, I don't see the value in you having an LLC. An LLC is more if there's a business interest. And because of how you're handling this for tax purposes and how you're using the property, it's more of a personal interest. So I think in your situation, the umbrella route is the better way to go, with a discussion with your broker about when you have subcontractors on premise. Is there any sort of protection you can have? Or is there anything you should be asking them when they come on your property have coverage?
That's a good point. I'll have to look into that a little bit more.
Barb, what are your thoughts on entities? How have you done things in the past?
Megan's the expert on this, and I totally and completely agree with everything she said. But I did want to say that, you know, we've talked about a lot of the pitfalls here, and I think that's really, really good, because there's so many places online that glamorize real estate investing. And it's like any other type of job that you have, whether it be a full-time or a part-time job. There's pros and cons, there's ways to make money, but it's not easy. And you can't just take a course and boom, you'll just get into it and make oodles of money. So it's really important whenever you get into something like real estate investing, flipping, that you do your homework. And I thought that Paul was just such a smart example of how he really did his due diligence. I love the idea that he shadowed someone who was a real estate investor to really learn the ins and outs. And I think that's a wonderful example of how to really approach this endeavor.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's excellent advice, is learning from others. One thing I did want to get into, because I think it's instructive for people, especially from the experienced people here on the panel. Barb, I want to talk about your kind of worst flip experience. Do you have an example of that you care to share with the listeners?
Well, I think the worst flip experience has to do with not so much flipping, but buying a property, adding some value, and then renting it. And I've got a lot of, you know, unfortunate examples of difficulty with tenants. So it kind of goes hand in hand in that many people who flip also rent. And when you are a landlord, again, another field that seems so exciting, oh, I'll buy it, I'll rent it out. Well, there are so many ways you can have difficulty with tenants, such as non-payment of rent, such as trashing the property, such as having to evict someone, which is a horrible, horrible experience. Again, just be aware of the negative things that may go wrong when you're involved in real estate investing.
Mindy, what about you? What's your worst flip experience?
We purchased a home in 2006. See where this is going? We hired a contractor to add a second story. They left Friday night, tarped up the roof, and a 500-year storm happened Friday night, Saturday. Rain was pouring in through the light fixtures on the first level that we were living in. There was rain pouring down the driveway. It had this weird driveway that faced, like, that angled towards the house. Rain poured down the driveway through the garage into the basement. It was like this nightmare that would never end. I had a brand new baby at the time. I was able to find one spot in the middle of the bed where she wouldn't get rained on. And then we were just taking buckets everywhere. The contractor, the 3-month contract turned into 6 months because it always does. I should have known better, but I didn't. And the contractor ended up running away with the money to pay the drywall guy. I was able to protect myself because my dad had, like, casually mentioned the week before, oh, make sure you get signed lien waivers from all of your subcontractors before you pay the final bill. And if he hadn't have said that, and if I hadn't had the drywall contractor sign this lien waiver, I would have been out another $11,000. And I feel terrible that the contractor was out $11,000. It really broke my heart when he called me and I was like, what? They didn't pay you? But that purchase was supposed to be, when we sold that house, it was supposed to hit up on the $500,000 exemption limit. And thanks to 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12, we ended up making $100,000 on it instead of like $450,000 that we thought we were going to make on it.
Wow. That...
Yeah, so that was fun.
Well, at least you made money. It doesn't sound
we
like
did.
Quality but of life when, was very good.
Yeah, that was a tough one.
Let's kind of end it with this, especially Barb and Mindy, you've got a lot of experience. What's some kind of experience you can kind of leave the listeners with or some advice you can leave them with that they can take away from this if they're thinking about the fix and flip? Barb, you want to start?
Yeah, I'd probably start out with interviewing some people that do this, just so that you can learn about it. And there's a ton of courses out there. I can't speak to those one way or the other, but I can speak to the benefit that comes from actually getting in there, talking to people that have done this, the fixing, the flipping, and know what you're getting into. Make sure you have extra cash because it always costs more than you think it will. So I would suggest really saving up till you have a nice little stash of cash and you're a good risk. So if you do need to borrow some money, which you probably will, you'll have more likelihood of getting that loan. I'm Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance or Robo Advisor Pros.
Thanks, Barb. Mindy, what's the best piece of advice you give people about flipping?
I agree with everything Barb said, and I'm going to tack on. It is not nearly as glamorous as HGTV makes it seem. So if you think you're going to get in there and just make $1 million and everything's going to go smooth, you are going to learn a very painful lesson rather quickly. Learn your real estate market and know what you can sell the property for when it's finished. Don't just rely on your real estate agent, but absolutely ask them for advice on what they feel it can sell for when it's done. And list slightly low, like Barb said, list slightly low so you can sell it quick, because chasing that extra $5,000 and the market changes or, you know, something else comes on the market and sells instead of yours, it can sit there and sit there and sit there. And once it's sat there, it's stale and people don't want to touch it at all. And have multiple exit strategies. So in case you do finish up the flip and the market has changed while you're flipping, you can still do something with the property.
And where can people find more about you, Mindy?
I am all over biggerpockets.com. I'm the community manager there, and I host their money podcast called Bigger Pockets Money.
Yeah, and I suggest everybody listen to that show. It's a wonderful show. Megan, what about you?
I always come back from the same perspective, but if you're going to go down this path, whether you're going to do it the way Mindy's doing it, where you live in the home, or you are using it as a flip, or even renting it, talk to your tax professional. You want to make sure you're aware of the pitfalls. And then occasionally you might find out there's some really good news in what you're doing. And you want to make sure you stay on top of things. So I'm Megan Gorman, and you can find me at thewealthintersection.com or on Twitter at Wealth Intersect. Thanks for having me on.
And that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can also find more about me at innovativewealth.com, as well as finding me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to our show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.